supporting solutions to prevent and end homelessness. On the web at melvilletrust.org.
A lot happens between 9 and noon.
I was a dumb kid, regardless of the fact that I was 18. I have two jobs right now.
I'm feeling more American now that I have children that are growing up here.
This is the Daily Circuit on Minnesota Public Radio News.
I'm Tom Weber, along with Mark Zdechlik. This hour, would you ever live next to a football stadium? As plans are being drawn up for a new Viking stadium, there's a lot of talk about how to also spur development in that part of downtown Minneapolis. That's going to be our topic this hour.
Tom, we're also going to get an update on an investigation of the Cook County attorney over his relationship with a teenaged family friend.
And then next hour, Star Tribune food writer Rick Nelson will join us to talk about new restaurants, and hopefully he'll bring some cookies.
But we'll start it off with an update of regional news. Bus company executive Charlie Zelli, who's preparing to take the job of Minnesota Transportation Commissioner, told Minnesota Public Radio this morning that he expects there will be a conversation soon about raising fuel taxes to pay for Minnesota transportation projects.
That's really pretty clear, and I think it's clear to all of us, just as citizens, that we need resources for this kind of valuable infrastructure. And the current resources just aren't sufficient, as when you take a kind of a long-term 20-year look. So is the gas tax going to be part of the conversation? Oh, I can imagine it will.
Zelli also said he thinks a shift to taxing vehicles for the miles they drive rather than the fuel they use will be the future of transportation financing. But he said that probably is not practical in the immediate future. Zelli succeeds Transportation Commissioner Tom Sorrell, who left the agency December 1st to become the CEO of AAA of Minneapolis. New census numbers show a sharp increase in poverty in Minnesota between 2007 and 2011, but the numbers also show the increase in poverty started to slow in 2010. Dan Frank is a program supervisor at the Initiative Foundation in Little Falls. He says in the 14 counties where his foundation provides programs, many families work two or more low-paying jobs.
These families are not very far from that poverty line. And, of course, ever since the recession started, and even before that to a degree, but certainly more so with the recession starting in 2007, we've had families slip off and slip down into poverty.
Many of the poorest counties in Minnesota are in the northern part of the state. Ramsey County is the poorest among the metro counties. U.S. and Canadian officials are meeting today in Minneapolis to talk about improving water quality in the Red River Basin. The Red River flows into Lake Winnipeg, and pollution from farms and cities is contributing to a growing dead zone in that lake. Canadian Council General Jamshed Merchant says the conference is a way to start solving a critical environmental problem.
It's about people and our relationships to the land and water that we live on, right? So everyone has a role in this. So it's really about building awareness. As you develop that, then you can say, okay, what's the next step? What do we have to do? What do we tackle?
Merchant says he hopes the conference will start a dialogue and lead to more clean water collaboration across the U.S.-Canadian border. Tom, that is a regional news update.
Thanks, Mark. Although we're going to stay regional here, we have the latest here out of Cook County up in northeastern Minnesota.
Yeah, Tom, we wanted to update our listeners on a development in a story that NPR News has been following for the past year. The sheriff in Cook County has asked the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension to investigate Cook County Attorney Tim Scannell after a family obtained a restraining order to keep Scannell away from their teenaged daughter. The restraining order was requested after Scannell allegedly informed the family of a romantic relationship with the girl. Scannell is at the center of a story reported by NPR News' Dan Crocker in February about relationships between adult men and teenage girls in Grand Marais. Here's Scannell discussing the issue on the Daily Circuit in last February.
I mean, I understand it's going to be natural for us to focus on the girls, but this behavior is something that has to stop with the adults, and it's something that the rest of us adults who are responsible and understand the difficulties of going through adolescent development that we have to speak out about so that we can educate the other adults who are causing this negative behavior.
Joining us now is NPR News reporter Tim Nelson. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning, Mark.
First, let's just remind people of who this county attorney is. He was in the news a lot about a year ago.
Right. He is the prosecutor in Grand Marais who first came to public prominence last December when he was nearly shot and killed in the courthouse. He'd won a conviction in court against another Grand Marais man for criminal sexual conduct with an underage girl. The perpetrator in that case went out to his car, got a gun, came back into the courthouse and opened fire. He shot Scannell and another man. Now, he was charged with attempted murder in that case, but died while he was being held at the St. Louis County Jail in Duluth.
And now this case is taking an altogether almost bizarre turn. What's the latest with this right now?
Well, as you said, the family of a 17-year-old Graham Murray girl has obtained this restraining order that's intended to keep the Cook County attorney away from her. Part of the court proceedings here had a copy of this order delivered to the sheriff's office. I talked to the sheriff yesterday. That's Mark Falk. He said he'd read through the order, decided the details in it deserved a second look with an eye towards violations of law, not just that this family was worried about something and had reason to seek this order. Now, the paperwork itself says that the girl is 17. It acknowledges that she's the age of consent. You know, remember, this is the same issue that came up with the DFL representative Carrie Gauthier in Duluth earlier this year.
Mm-hmm.
But typically in cases like this, investigators look to see if there was anything that might have happened before a situation came to light, presumably when the girl might have been younger in this case. But I want to be totally clear here. The BCA doesn't discuss ongoing investigations in detail, so we don't know what they might actually be looking into. The sheriff says he's turning this over to a third party because technically Scannell is his lawyer. Scannell doesn't just prosecute crimes. He represents the legal interests of the whole county, including the sheriff's office. So the sheriff wants to avoid any appearance of a conflict of interest here.
Now, he's an elected official, but he's also a prosecutor. How rare is it that he's facing, you know, possible criminal charges?
Well, you know, I remember, I can't remember the exact year, but many years ago, Ramsey County attorney being charged with DWI. But I've talked to some law enforcement folks, and they can't recall anything like it. An apology that Scannell issued this week indicates that he's been with the county attorney's office up there for the last 8 years. He was elected to be the county attorney in 2006 and again in 2010. So this incident is a very, very serious development in the career of a chief law enforcement officer in Cook County and a veteran chief law enforcement officer.
And we mentioned at the outset here that this is related to a restraining order that this family obtained. That is on the NPR News website right now. I've looked at it very briefly. You've gone through it much more closely. What do you make of it?
Well, it's many pages long, and I want to be clear. We have redacted it so that we don't identify the victim in this case or her family. We've done the best we can to, you know, they've expressed some concern about attention to her, and we've tried to, you know, reflect that. But when you look through this paperwork, it includes what purports to be email messages from the county attorney himself to one of the parents of this young woman explaining this situation. It also describes his initial disclosure to the girl's mother when he dropped in on her workplace, at least as the mother recalled it. It says that Scannell told her he'd given her daughter a necklace and that he read aloud some poetry he'd written to the girl. He also allegedly told the mom that they'd discuss having children together at some point, but they decided he'd be too old. Now, there's some hints in here. You kind of read between the lines that the family's been trying to deal with this on their own, even contacting relatives of Scannell, hoping that they'd get him to move on and drop this matter. It suggests that they were contemplating court action against Scannell as early as September, but feared asking for a court order that would make this whole matter public and bring even more unwanted attention to their daughter. It also says that the girl left the state for schooling and that her mother came to believe during a Thanksgiving break that Scannell had continued to send packages and mail to the girl and that they'd been talking perhaps via Skype, the online video application. Again here, Scannell hasn't been charged with any crime, and this court proceeding doesn't include any response from him about these allegations, so we have not heard from him yet. The only thing he's said really so far is a statement issued by his attorney expressing his regret for what he said was a breach of trust with his constituents.
Tim, to add sort of the other layer to this, so this girl and her family were very well known to Scannell and his family, right?
Yeah, according to the order, the families have been friends since this girl was in elementary school. It says Scannell gave her guitar lessons, coached her in a summer tennis camp. It even says that one of Scannell's sons took the girl to prom the spring of their sophomore year in high school. The order describes Scannell as her coach, a friend, a mentor, and her family is clearly familiar with many of the details of his life. The girl's mom even described for the court asking Scannell what he would do if she were dating Scannell's son. She wrote that Scannell just laughed and called the idea ridiculous.
Wow. Well, what happens next? Where do you go? There are potential criminal and political ramifications for the county attorney, huh?
Well, that's sort of up to the BCA now. Presumably, they're going to investigate and eventually find a prosecutor to review their findings just to make sure their decision to pursue or not pursue charges is carefully reviewed. That could be a county attorney from another county. The state's attorney general office often provides legal assistance in greater Minnesota with complex and sensitive criminal matters that local prosecutors might not have a lot of experience with. If Scannell is charged with a crime, he could face a number of challenges. He might have to recuse himself from his duties as a prosecutor. The state's Lawyers Professional Responsibility Board has rules that say attorneys that commit criminal acts that, and I'm quoting here, reflects on the lawyer's honesty, trustworthiness, or fitness as a lawyer in other respects could be professional misconduct that could bar him from practicing law. Again, also, his term of office is up in 2 years. He has said he wants to regain the trust of his constituents, but whether he's charged with a crime or not, he's going to have to face the judgment of Cook County if he runs for re-election.
Very good. Tim, thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you.
That's NPR News reporter Tim Nelson talking about a Bureau of Criminal Apprehension investigation into the conduct of Cook County attorney Tim Scannell and a relationship with a teenage girl up in Cook County, Tom.
Thank you, Mark. We're going to spend the rest of the hour talking about whether a new Viking stadium can actually spark an actual honest-to-goodness neighborhood. Stadiums are not necessarily known for doing that. Just look at the current Metrodome. The Dome and future stadium stand in a part of Minneapolis known as Downtown East. It's not a hub of, well, much of anything. It's not the place to buy a condo or rent an apartment. It's not the place to go eat and visit restaurants. It's not the place to shop. Why not? And could the new stadium be all those things? There's actually a committee looking into this question. What has to be part of the design that will actually do what I just noted? And for a handful of days throughout the year, keeping in mind that this part of Minneapolis will be crawling with football and other event foot traffic. So what about the rest of the year? Can it be the next hipster, trendy place to live? How do you make a behemoth stadium inviting to businesses and residential development? I want to hear your ideas. What would it take for you to want to live next to a stadium? What would you incorporate into the design to achieve what I've just noted? And have you seen this done really well in other cities? Tell me about that. What would it take? 1-800-242-2828-651-227-6000. You can also go to the feature page on the Daily Circuit website. Leave your comments there. You can tweet me at WeberTom1. Tom Fisher is dean of the College of Design at the University of Minnesota. He thinks about this. He's co-chair of this committee I was talking about, and he's with us in the studio. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Good to be here.
Do you love thinking about this and talking about this?
Oh, yes. I mean, this is what our disciplines do. Architecture, landscape architecture, urban design, this is what we think about all the time.
Very good. Tim Chapin also with us on the phone. He chairs the Department of Urban and Regional Planning at Florida State University. He has written a lot about these issues, merging stadia with urban planning, and he's with us this morning in Tallahassee. Thank you for your time, Tim.
Good morning to you.
Appreciate your time. So, Tom Fisher, as we go forward, everyone's saying, don't do what they did with the Metrodome. Mm-hmm. Is it pretty much a guarantee that we're not going to make those same mistakes, or is it possible we'll fall down that cliff as well?
Well, I don't know if it's a guarantee, but I'm co-chairing with David Wilson a Stadium District Implementation Committee that is trying very hard to make sure that we don't make that mistake again, that, in fact, the district around the new stadium is as lively an urban district as we can make it.
Tim Chapin, can a stadium be built that people want to live across the street from?
The answer is absolutely yes. It's been done in a few cities with success, and I'm sure we can talk about some of those this morning. But there's been in Cleveland and San Diego, there's been some stadium investments that have really contributed to placemaking in those central cities. So It's possible. It's hard to do, and it costs some money, but it can be done.
It sounds, though, like what you just said there is that it's also the exception to the rule?
From my experience and my research, yes, very much so the exception, particularly for football stadiums.
So why is it different for football stadiums? Is it just the number of dates for games?
Well, the number of dates, the size of the venue is oftentimes much bigger than certainly arenas and ballparks, and just the nature of football with people wanting to tailgate. And so many of these stadiums get followed by massive sort of surface parking lots that do great for killing the sense of place on non-game days. So parking's a huge issue.
Tom Fisher, we know all about that with the current Metrodome.
Yes, absolutely. I think the challenge and the opportunity with the Viking Stadium is it may be one of the first really urban football stadiums in the country. I mean, I'm aware of San Diego and Cleveland have done a good job, but they're still at...
Those are baseball parks.
One was an arena. San Diego's a baseball park. The Cleveland Stadium is at the edge of the downtown, same with Indianapolis. But we're actually putting the Viking Stadium in the middle of the downtown. I mean, it's not at the edge. And so I think it's really an opportunity for us to think about what it means to create urbanity around a football stadium, because it's true, most of them are suburban in location and certainly in character with big surface parking lots around them.
So what is it then, as you've looked on this committee, Tom, I mean, are there two or three things that are musts that really, I mean, I'm going back to that question, why would I want to live across the street from a place that blows up into, you know, this loud thing for a few Sundays of the year?
Right. Well, I think parking, as was just been said, is really one of the key issues. And so how do we accommodate tailgating without big surface parking lots? There are examples of how this is done in Europe around soccer stadiums that I think are interesting. There are some – we're looking at ways of having tailgating parking ramps that would stack things vertically. We're looking, of course, at the opportunity that light rail provides. There will be large percentages of Viking fans who will come by rail. So rail gating, using a term that Mayor Rybak developed, where there might be tailgating on distant parking lots, and then people would then take the train to the game.
So tailgate at the Mall of America.
Yeah, possibly.
And then hop on the train.
And get right off at the stadium. I think another thing we're looking at, and this is done in Europe at times, which is the district around the stadium during game day closes and people tailgate on the streets. So the streets become kind of tailgating parking lots during the game but just prior to the game. And so there are ways to do this, and we're investigating all of them.
Is the firm that is drawing up the designs, the architecture firm, and I believe late January, early February, they're actually due, so we're actually going to see some of these first renderings and thoughts. Is this just getting hammered into them so much that they're going to do this, or are you worried this might fall through on that level?
Well, I think the design team is very aware and sympathetic to these ideas. Of course, they're focused on designing the stadium. Our committee is really looking at the whole district, and that's going to be a longer-term proposition, development parcels around the stadium that aren't the responsibility of the stadium architects themselves.
Tim Chapin, where do you see... I mean, one of the things I think of, I grew up in the Chicago area, and we think about how Wrigley Field is so beautifully, you know, ingrained with its neighborhood. But then I think about it and think, well, now, wait a minute. That's because it's so old. And it, frankly, Wrigley Field grew up with the neighborhood. When we come to Minneapolis, this part of downtown Minneapolis is so, well, empty, frankly. It does seem in a weird way, and maybe this is just me proselytizing, that you actually have an opportunity to do the same thing. There's no neighborhood there per se. Does that help? I mean, we could build this whole thing from the ground up.
Absolutely. In fact, I've been to Minneapolis several times and have walked around the Metrodome site and that neighborhood, and there is a real opportunity for Minneapolis to sort of break the mold. Professor Fisher is exactly right. I think looking to Europe and some of the experiences of the stadiums and the district investments there makes a great deal of sense. But to your question of sort of is the fact that the stadium as it currently stands is surrounded by a lot of underdeveloped parcels, this is a remarkable opportunity for a city that is well known nationally for the quality of its planning and its redevelopment and its design and its architecture. So I think having it's not quite a blank slate, but a very much empty slate to work with is a great advantage.
Tom Fisher, these parking lots that are in downtown East right now, there's got to be a reason they're there, right? You're making money. Is it a slam dunk that if you're the owner of this lot and switch it to some kind of mixed use, some kind of development, that you wouldn't lose money? I mean, isn't there? I mean, that's certainly the owners of this land have their concerns.
Well, I think we have to keep in mind that the area around the Metrodome was consciously created this way. At the time of its construction in the 1980s, there was worry that a district would compete with the warehouse district on the other side of the downtown. And so it was intentionally created so that it wouldn't be competing. So, for example, there were no liquor licenses or maybe one liquor license given out for the whole area. So, I mean, there were things that were done to discourage development, which is why it ended up the way it is. The city doesn't want to do that again. I think they realize that whatever we do around the stadium, the new stadium isn't going to be competing with the warehouse district, which is really well established now. And so I think that there's a real opportunity to develop a lot of this empty land and to do it in a mixed-use way. I think one of the other things that's really important is that light rail stop, which is now just a stop on the Hiawatha line, is going to be the main transfer station for everyone from St. Paul or the university who want to go into the Mall of America or the airport. And so it's going to become a major rail transfer point right in front of the stadium, which I think will bring a lot of other commercial, residential activity to that area apart from the stadium.
Mark on Twitter here says, open air and noise, monster trucks, loud rock shows, 50,000 drunks, not in my backyard. And that's a comment. And I think a lot of people Mark, I think he was a little tongue-in-cheek there, but he does not want it there. And that's a prevalent thought that, why, you're crazy to think I would ever want to live next to a stadium.
Well, some people might not. Other people might like the excitement and the energy of that. And again, it's only 10 times, at most, 10 times a year.
But there's other events.
Well, there are, but those are small. I mean, we're not talking about huge crowds on the other venues that would happen in the stadium. And so it's not really that intrusive. We also may see a lot of office development. The HCMC is right there. You know, you can envision medical offices. It's going to be extremely well connected by transportation, not only highways and parking garages, but all of the light rail connections.
We're talking about what it would take when this stadium, this new Viking stadium, is built for you to want to live right next to it. Give me a call, 1-800-242-2828, 651-227-6000. Tom Fisher is with us. He's the dean of the College of Design over at the University of Minnesota, also on this committee that's actually talking about this very issue. Tim Chapin with us from Florida State University. He writes a lot about how stadiums and urban planning meet. Tim Chapin, you noted that you have actually visited Minneapolis. Where do you see the best potential there? Is it office space like Tom was talking about? Is it residential? Is it a bunch of bars? I mean, what is the neighborhood that you would envision if you were going to put it together?
Well, I think over the long run, a successful neighborhood will involve a little bit of all of that. Given the proximity to downtown, it makes great sense for further office and other sort of commercial enterprises to be there. But there was this the Twitter comment you read about, well, I wouldn't want to live next to a stadium with 50,000 drunks. There are a lot of people who feel that way, but there are many people who want a vibrant urban district that they can walk around in. They can hop on the train to get to work, to get to the airport. And in fact, that's a largely underbuilt sector of the real estate market. There's a lot of demand there, and I think that demand's only going to be increasing. So I do think there's a real promise for further residential development throughout, much of downtown and near downtown. But if this district is done well, I think I could imagine easily with the light rail, the small blocks, the accessibility to downtown, the university, a real opportunity for people to live there.
Yoni is on the phone this morning in Minneapolis. Yoni, how would you do this? What would it take for you to want to live next to a new stadium? Hello?
Well, a couple suggestions. Can you hear me?
Yeah, go for it.
Okay, great. A couple of suggestions that I had, coming from someone who is a football fan but is more of a sit-on-my-couch football fan and avoid the stadium at all costs. Two things. If you were to open up the zoning for food trucks to be able to vend, not just on game day, which I know they were doing for the railgating, but potentially even throughout the season, on the weekends or however that would make sense. And also to open up some restrictions just in that area on game day for some sanctioned, licensed street performances. Those two things for me would make me, as someone in the area, interested in going down there to not only people watch and check out the spectacle, but know that there's something else there for me that's more of a destination.
Okay, and, you would be willing.
Food and art are you know what makes a neighborhood for me.
But Yoni, one of the other things you said, Yoni, was that you would go down there. Would you live there?
Well, that's a whole other question. I don't know that I would personally live there, but I think that someone who wants to live in a more dense and urban community would find the diversity of everything from football games to rock concerts to street performers and street food to be a pretty rich cultural experience compared to what you would imagine just being outside of your window and worrying about the, drunk football fans.
Thanks so much, Yoni. To his thoughts there, Tom.
Well, I agree. I also agree with Professor Chapin that there is definitely a market for this. I think that it's the kind of urbanism that American cities haven't often offered their residents, but it is what attracts people to cities around the world. I also, one of the things we're looking at with the stadium, and I don't know if this is going to be possible, is the idea that the food vendors inside the stadium could also service outside the stadium. In other words, instead of only being a food service during games or other events, that the perimeter of the stadium itself might be able to offer food venues of various kinds.
They become restaurants or bars.
Exactly. So the stadium goes. This one of the biggest problems with football stadiums is sort of like this big blank spaceship that lands in cities. So how do you make the edges active? And we think there's some opportunities there.
So it's not. So obviously we have a dome. We have a spaceship right now that's a dome. It's this walled off building. Even if it's an open air stadium, it still has the potential.
It does.
To be this wall of
spaceship. Activity. It should be a wall of activity. It should generate activity rather than wall it off.
Is there an example now where that does happen, where you have the restaurants flipping out like that?
No, not that I know of in the U.S. Now, there are ballparks that do this. I mean, the San Diego ballpark is really great in the way it's generated activity around its edges. But if we can achieve this here, it might be the first football stadium to do this.
There's a comment here from Tom on Twitter. Minneapolis will never get it right. It's just his comment there. So certainly some feelings there for sure. Eric's on the phone in St. Peter. Good morning, Eric.
Good morning. Yes, actually, I was going to suggest the same thing, a kind of arcade on the outside that included both restaurants and boutiques so that it's outward-looking as well as kind of inward-looking. And I also think that the Twin Cities are a great kind of biking zone, and so I think some kind of pedestrian focus would really fit well with population.
All right, thanks so much for the comment there, Tim Chapin. In addition to what Tom just talked about this idea of maybe flipping those restaurants so they work both sides of the wall, I guess you would say, what about those streets around it, as Eric was talking about? I mean, Tom talked about closing them down on game day for tailgating, but do you need to shut those down permanently, or do you keep those open as well? I mean, what is the importance of keeping roads open in and around the stadium as well?
Well, over the long run, it's hard to imagine shutting them down permanently. There was a big sort of rise in pedestrian malls back in the 70s in this country, and the vast majority of those ended up not doing very well. There are a few good ones out there, but they're hard to do, and they tend to be very idiosyncratic. The roads need to be roads, but I think the message that and the lesson to be learned from other places is that They need to be urban. They need to be urban roadways. They need to offer that exciting sort of urban setting. They need, you know, they need a nice architecture. They need street trees. They need street furniture. There's this idea of investing sort of outside the boundaries of the stadium. And I think one of the great mistakes that you'll find in most cities that have not done it well, and that's the vast majority of them when it comes to football stadiums, is the investment sort of stops at the edge of the stadium. And I do think there is going to be needed for investment on the boulevards, on the streets, in the surrounding area to sort of send this signal. We care about the lands outside of the footprint of the stadium.
How much, Tom Fisher, of what passed and what's going to be built here, you know, the bill that passed and now we're going to have a new Viking stadium, what footprint does that have? And is everything outside the stadium walls now the city of Minneapolis's responsibility?
Well, no, there is a sort of within a red line, there's a piece of property that includes not just the stadium, but some parking and plaza space. It's part of the $975 million investment. And so it isn't just the building itself, although Professor Chapin is right that so often the investment stops at the edge of the building, and we have to make sure that doesn't happen, that there is great public space provided. And the Sports Facility Authority and the Vikings are very well aware and supportive of that idea.
Elizabeth on Twitter says, if you make it a nice place with benches to eat your lunch on and some shade, that would go a long way. That gets to what Tim Chapin just talked about. Tom Fisher is also with us this hour. We're talking about what it would take for you to want to live next to the new Viking Stadium. We have some calls we're going to get to. A lot of people calling up, so I want to hear from you. 1-800-242-2828-651-227-6000. We will get to that after a quick check of news with Mark Zedeklik. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Tom. For the first time, Russia is acknowledging that the regime of Bashar Assad in Syria is cracking under the force of a powerful rebellion. Russia is Syria's most powerful ally. A Russian foreign ministry official says Assad is losing control of his country and that the rebels might win the civil war there. NATO today is also predicting the fall of Assad. The alliance's secretary general says the collapse of the regime is only a matter of time. A leading conservative Republican is predicting that President Barack Obama will win the fight over taxes in the fiscal cliff negotiations. Jim DeMint, who's resigning from the Senate to lead the Conservative Heritage Foundation, told CBS this morning that a tax increase would amount to a political trophy for Obama, but that it would be bad for the country. Democrats say House Speaker John Boehner is unwilling to crack on the key issue of raising taxes on the wealthy. And House Democratic Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi is now warning against raising the Medicare eligibility age. Stocks have been holding steady since the opening bell after the government reported that weekly applications for unemployment benefits fell to the second lowest level this year. There's also word today that wholesale prices fell last month for the second month in a row, a sign that inflation remains mild. The drop of 0.8%, the steepest since May, was driven in large part by cheaper gasoline. More is coming up next on the Daily Circuit.
Support comes from the St. Paul Foundation, a community foundation committed to helping clients and their families create a lasting legacy in St. Paul and neighboring communities. More at stpaulfoundation.org, building St. Paul through decades of generosity.
Programming is supported by the College of St. Scholastica, an independent college rated in the top tier of Midwestern colleges and universities by U.S. News & World Report's 2013 Best Colleges Rankings, css.edu.
Friday and Morning Edition, a look at how the Catholic Church is trying to heal internal rifts created by the Minnesota Marriage Amendment debate. I'm Kathy Werzer. We'll have that story and all the news. Morning Edition, weekdays from 4 to 9 a.m. here on Minnesota Public Radio News.
Call in with your comments, 651-227-6000 or 800-242-2828. This is The Daily Circuit on Minnesota Public Radio News.
I'm Tom Weber. We're talking this hour with Tom Fisher from the University of Minnesota and Tim Chapin from Florida State University about what this new Viking Stadium that's going to be built, how it can be built to encourage an actual neighborhood to pop up around it. We're getting a lot of calls here as well, so I'm going to go to those right away. Joram is on the phone this morning in Northfield. Good morning, Joram.
Hi, good morning.
Yeah, your comment.
Well, I was going to comment on the possibility of a pedestrian street, but then that's been addressed somewhat as possibly being difficult. And mm-hmm. I like the comment that one of your guests made about investing in the streets and boulevards around the stadium and creating this district. I wonder if you could possibly, if a pedestrian street is not possible, could you have some one-way streets with a significant amount of the street designed in the way that they're talking about to create some interesting space? And maybe that can combine with the food trucks and the street performers that another caller mentioned.
All right. Good question, Tom Fisher.
Well, I think absolutely we need to bring back the urban grid, create urban streets. I'm not so sure about one-way streets. Actually, in some ways, it makes it less safe because it encourages people to speed up. I think the more we can do to put back sort of normal urban streets with wide sidewalks, boulevard trees is the very things that Professor Chapin was talking about, and normalize it as an urban district, I think the better it will be. However, there are subtleties. For example, we could design the curbs in such a way that they could be the streets could turn into tailgating spaces on game day and then return back to normal sidewalks and streets the rest of the time.
Tim Chapin, though, it seems very difficult, and maybe this is why it's the exception to the rule, but what we're talking about is creating a quote-unquote normal neighborhood, but then 10 or 12 dates a year. For example, all the restaurants in the area would have to bring it all up to scale. They'd have to boost everything up so that they could serve, you know, hundreds and hundreds of people. So for 10 days a year, they have to act like a restaurant that serves thousands of people. And then for the rest of the days of the year, they have to act like a restaurant that, you know, only gets the normal traffic. How do you do that?
Well, the beautiful thing about that is that there are 10 to 12 predictable days a year. You know, the schedule sets relatively early. You know, they can staff up, they can supply up in that sense. You know, to me, it's the worry is not so much the 10 or 12 days a year that there are events, because I think the restaurants do, assuming they're serving good food, they're going to do just fine. It's the 350 days of the year otherwise that's the real concern, and that's where the district and the office workers and the other commercial activity, that's what needs to be there to support those restaurants. So again, I worry less about game days. It's the non-game days that really will drive whether or not this district is successful.
Steph Curtis, people are commenting on our feature page about this on the Daily Circuit website.
That's right. Mark says, I hope that the stadium expands the downtown Minneapolis footprint. It seems that the downtown skyscrapers end at around 4th Avenue, and I would hope that the stadium would bring new office and condominium tower investment to eastern downtown. This will bring new restaurants and other amenities, as well as make Minneapolis more of an, he puts this in quotes, big city. And Matt says, as a former resident of Elliott Park, I have to voice my disappointment in the potential displacement of a significant number of low-income residents and seniors in the name of progress.
I want to get to both of those for sure. Tom Fisher, do you envision downtown east being tower filled, or is it more of the neighborhood with 3-4-story buildings?
Well, it's a little hard to know at the moment how the market will respond. I definitely think it needs to be denser and it needs to have a great street life. Whether the buildings are 6 stories or, you know, 26 stories is a little hard to tell at the moment.
What about the low income people in that area?
Well, I think, you know, Elliott Park, as is represented on our committee, we're very concerned about it being a mixed income as well as a mixed use neighborhood. And we are really going to work hard to make sure that, for example, the Elliott Park neighborhood residents are not displaced.
Sonia's on the phone this morning in Minneapolis. Good morning, Sonia. You have experience. You live near a stadium?
Yes. Good morning. I used to live in Pasadena near the Rose Bowl. And that is a huge football stadium. It seats 100,000 people. And surprisingly enough, it's located in a rather exclusive neighborhood. And the thing is that there really are no restaurants or anything around it, but within a mile is Old Town, and that's like a destination spot anyway. So they actually sustain each other. And so you don't have to worry about, like, those football days or, you know, show days like that. It's just always there.
Tim Chapin, something to learn from the Rose Bowl example. Thank you, Sona.
Well, in the near term, when the new stadium gets built, many people will end up taking care of their food needs and their shopping needs on game day in existing restaurants. So in the near term, I suspect the new stadium will continue as the current one has, and that people will tailgate, but they'll also eat downtown and in other nearby neighborhoods. It's in the longer view, is there able to be created an urban district that can be sustained year-round? where the restaurants are within walking districts, within walking distance, and if you get off the train, can you stop in a pub on your way into the game? So in the near term, people will continue, I suspect, to eat where they're eating. But in 20 years, what's the urban district going to look like? And I think that's the longer term view that we're talking about here today.
Let's go to Dan, who's on the phone in St. Paul. Good morning, Dan.
Good morning. Thanks. It's a great topic. I'm fortunate in that I grew up in Washington, D.C., so I saw the wrong way to do it, and the way the Redskins built the park, quite literally in the middle of nowhere. They have one service road out to what is now FedEx Stadium, and it's 3 hours to get out of that park. So it's the exact opposite of what you want to do. And I had the opportunity to see when they built Camden Yards and rescued an absolutely destroyed inner-city core with the park, and then they got really lucky in a way we probably can't replicate, because they can share parking between the baseball stadium and the new football stadium. Hmm. But the football stadium has high-rise living within, 60 feet of the doorway to the football stadium. There's tons of restaurants around. It's an absolutely vibrant area virtually every night, but certainly on nights when there's football or there's events. And it's almost seamless from my perspective how they fit together. But, maybe that can only be done where there is already existing surface-level and multi-level parking. But that would seem to be a model that we would try to capture. And there's also a number of highways that go in and out of there. Mm-hmm. So it's a challenging site, but they've done it. They pulled it off. And I think it was HOK that did both as far as the architects. They seem to be the superstars. But I really love you guys talking about this. Thank you for it.
Thank you, Dan. And Tom Fisher talking about D.C. is a failure, Baltimore is a mm-hmm. success. The highways we've got, that's there. But he's talking specifically on the success, especially about that parking question.
Yeah. Well, again, and the multimodal access to the Viking site is really going to help.
You're talking about light rail.
Yeah, light rail may, after it's all built out, might provide 30% to 40% of the fans maybe arriving by light rail, and so it's going to take some of the pressure off the parking problem.
But you're not going to get rid of it. You were talking, though, about how if we're going to build parking garages, parking ramps, there's a very nuanced difference about whether they're sloping levels or if they're actually flat levels.
Right. There's actually a really interesting parking garage. It's a tourist attraction in Miami Beach that has very high floor-to-floor heights, which has stores up in the garage, up in the ramp, and you can tailgate in a garage like that. So if you rethink the nature of a parking ramp and make it more a continuation of the street vertically, you can, in fact, stack tailgating.
So, okay, wait. This is a parking garage with high ceilings, and it actually has stores in the parking garage.
Up in it. And so you can drive up to a store and park right in front of it inside the parking ramp.
And then you tailgate there.
You can. It's high enough that you could tailgate. You could, roast brats inside a facility with a ceiling height that tall. And another thing we're talking about is actually having recreational space on the top deck of these parking ramps so that there would be soccer fields, tennis courts, other kinds of recreational opportunities for the public that could be on the roofs.
Okay. That sounds kind of cool, frankly. But, we're thinking big here, Tom, and we're thinking about all that can be. Mm-hmm. And then I listened back to our last caller talking about how they messed it all up in D.C. and, frankly, how a lot of mistakes were made here in Minneapolis. Mm-hmm. It seems, as Tim Chapin noted earlier, there's more failures than success at this experiment.
This is true, but we are benefiting from all those failures, learning what not to do. And I think there is a real commitment on the part of the city, the county, and the state to show that you can do this and we can do a better job.
There's also talk, connecting to downtown, but then you have to go up to that area where the Guthrie is. And then how are we going to cross the highway? You got Cedar Riverside over there. You got the West Bank. Seems like those highways are really cutting us all up there.
Well, that's right. In fact, there's been some talk about a wider sort of pedestrian bridge over the highways to connect to the university. And some of the development may, in fact, be university-related. There are a number of corporations that are interested in having a closer proximity to the research going on at the university, as well as the great development that's going on along the river. And so there's right now a conversation going on about redesigning Washington Avenue to make it much more pedestrian-friendly. That would enable people to connect to the river as well as connect more easily to the university.
Neil on Twitter says, healthy pedestrian-friendly streets with traffic combing features and year-round activity might help people accept the design. Cheryl's on the phone this morning in Bloomington. Cheryl, what's your idea?
I was wondering if there's been any thought on off days of having something like farmers markets facilities there.
Mm-hmm. Interesting, and that's actually an interesting example because in St. Paul, that's what they are going to do with the new Saints Stadium.
Right. That's a great idea. These are the kinds of ideas we're really eager to hear and incorporate. So
you're going to add that to the list?
Yeah, great.
All right. Let's go now to Nell, who is in Minneapolis. Good morning, Nell.
Hi. I appreciate what y'all are talking about, but I live on the light rail,
mm-hmm.
and it goes from the mall to downtown, and we live in a little cul-de-sac. We've lived there for 15 years. Used to be our grandma's house, right off Minnehaha Creek. It goes into Minnehaha Falls, down to Mississippi River. Very beautiful. We were told when they put the light rail in, we'll get pedestrian bridges and all this. We never did. We've had 4 or 5 people killed in that light rail in the last, 6 years. Right now, they put in 140 apartment, three-story apartment building. When you talk about 30 to 40% of the people coming in to see the games and 30 to 40% parking somewhere, mm-hmm. that's my neighborhood. Mm-hmm. I already have to pay to park in front of my house. If you came to visit me, I'd have to buy a permit for you to park there. We're lucky we have a garage. So if you... Nobody gave us any input into this massive apartment.
Mm-hmm.
They have only 80 slots of their underground parking. So where are the other 60 apartments going to park?
No, yeah.
And then also, when the light rail was put in, they didn't give us any of the stuff that they talked about, and people have been killed by coming off the bike trail and stuff because it's very, it's almost rural, our little cul-de-sac.
No.
So how can we believe that this is going to happen with the stadium?
Thank you very much. Great perspective, Nell, and I really appreciate you calling. I'm actually going to go to Tim Chapin first because I'm curious to know what Nell was talking about was this interesting thing about, yes, if you don't park downtown, you're going to park somewhere because you're parking and then going. Has anyone figured that out as far as how to kind of shuffle that along down the line, so to say?
Sure, sure. Well, you know, the parking is, frankly, probably the most dominant issue when it comes to solving this problem with these massive projects like stadiums. Where are you going to put the cars? In the Washington, D.C. model that was brought up before, it's essentially all on surface parking lots in a suburban setting off of a big highway, and that looks sort of like it's been the model there in Minneapolis. Moving to this distributed model where the cars are spread out in different locations, that's the better way to go, frankly, and that's the model I think that you're operating on. So there's that issue. The second point that Nell brought up that's real important is sort of pedestrian safety. In the United States, we have a lot of roads that, frankly, aren't very safe for people walking. The goal in this district, it sounds like, is to create streets with wider sidewalks, with on-street parking that buffers people from traffic, with street trees, with furniture that slows traffic down and sends a signal to drivers. You're not driving 50 miles an hour to get downtown. You're going to be driving a block at a time along this lovely promenade, and people are going to be walking, and it'll be safer. So there's this idea of design and placemaking that actually is a longer-term thing that will, I think, deal with some of these issues, although Nell brings up a good point.
And Tom Fisher, Nell's also talking about pedestrian safety all along the rail, not just downtown. She's talking about, mm-hmm. In her opinion, broken promises that they didn't do that along Hiawatha.
Well, yes, although, we focus on there have been a few people hit by trains. We compare that to the number of people killed by cars, and it's infinitesimally smaller. And so, it's still driving a car is the most dangerous thing you can do. In fact, it's the biggest killer, automobile accidents, the biggest killer between people age 5 to 34. So we tend to not think about all of the traffic-related deaths, and we have focused a bit on some of the deaths related to trains. Trains are still much safer than cars.
Jim is on the phone in this morning in Edina. Jim, how would you ever move from Edina to downtown to live next to the new Viking Stadium?
No, I sure wouldn't, but
I have to ask Vikings fans to hold their nose for a second and listen to this. You talked about Wrigley Field and the urban environment of my hometown, Chicago. Let me ask you to think about another stadium and what they've done, and that's Lambeau Field in Green Bay. As if you've ever been to Lambeau Field, you know that they are right across the street from a residential neighborhood and just on the edge of a well-established retail area. Smaller town, absolutely. But when Lambeau Field was rebuilt many years ago, they added an enormous atrium and turned it into a 340-day-a-year destination. If you're in Green Bay, you could go to Lambeau Field on non-game days any day of the year. There's multi-levels of dining, from fine dining to extremely casual. The Packers Hall of Fame, which is really a terrific sports museum, is co-located there. Of course, there's a gift shop for all the Packers swag anybody could ever want.
Mm-hmm.
But think about how little there is to do at the Excel Center or Target Center on non-game day. I think there might be a gift shop open. You could be in Green Bay with a couple hours to kill and go to Lambeau Field, and even if you're not a Packers fan, have a great experience. And it's well integrated into the neighborhood. So I'd ask, I'll take my answer off the air, but I'd like your guest to comment.
Great. Jim, thanks so much. Tim Chapin, you familiar with the Lambeau example?
Well, sure. And I think what the caller is speaking to is this idea of programming and design of the building so that it's multi-use. And again, if there's sort of one, you know, beyond the parking issue, the other key message to get across when it comes to looking at more successful stadiums and arenas versus the less successful ones is they are planned from the ground up to be multifunctional, to be to incorporate these other uses. Professor Fisher was talking before about having active space on the top of garages. You know, this is the type of thinking that needs to be happening now rather than as an afterthought, and that is how can we make this a people place more than just the 14 days a year that there happen to be events at the stadium.
Tom Fisher, if I'm going to do that, if I'm going to build the restaurant across the street, I'm going to build the parking ramp that has the restaurant on the fifth floor, and it's going to be tailgatable. Are there tax policies or issues with development laws in Minneapolis right now that would hinder me from doing that and make it more beneficial for me financially, if I own that land, to just keep it a parking lot?
Well, we are looking, as part of our committee, and the city itself is looking at possible regulatory changes to enable some of this to happen. So there is a group in city planning right now that are combing through the regulations to make sure that they don't get in the way.
City or state laws?
I'm familiar with what the city is doing. There may be state laws, too. I mean, there are a lot of lawyers involved in this project, and I think they're looking at some of these issues.
All right. Let's go to Chris, who's on the phone this morning in Minneapolis on line 9 there. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning.
Yeah, your comment, your experience?
Well, reiterating what everybody else said, we've got to make sure that this is something where people are going there more than eight days a year. I was in Phoenix when they built the big toaster in the middle of the suburbs, and what a disaster. You had a bunch of businesses, stores, retail, restaurants, and they all closed down within a year because nobody went out there except for a football game.
Yeah.
So just reiterating those facts, and we have a good opportunity to build a regional complex down there.
Thank you very much, Chris. And obviously this won't be in the suburbs, so some of that potentially Tom Fisher is solved there. Won't be a toaster out in the middle of nowhere.
Right. And we have been looking at Lambeau Field. I do think the previous caller's point about making it an entertainment venue that people will want to go to when there isn't a game going on is a very good one.
Terry's on the phone this morning in Minneapolis. Terry, thank you for waiting.
Sure, no problem. My thought is possibly to get football fans excited to live near the stadium, to maybe, with the new construction, either to rent or buy a condo or whatever, to give them season tickets along with their rental or purchase of a condo. And then also to have surrounding the stadium a pedestrian-only street surrounding the whole stadium with shopping, restaurants, et cetera, like everyone else is saying.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe also have a local Minnesota theme, food, retail stores, local only area, and then also maybe have the popular retail stores. But then on the parameter of the pedestrian street area, have underground parking from the outer edge.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Mm-hmm. Terry, you bring up an interesting point. Thanks so much. Tim Chapin, are you aware of maybe not season tickets, but some kind of incentives,
sorry for the loud crowd kind of thing that, that have happened in other cities for the development around stadiums?
I have a vague recollection of some things related to in Cleveland with the Indians when they built that ballpark, but I don't recall the specifics, and I wouldn't be shocked if I was wrong. You know, something like that is an interesting idea. You know, ultimately, though, the residential that's going to thrive around the stadium, frankly, is going to have nothing to do with the stadium beyond the level of investment and quality design. You know, there are, I'm sure, thousands upon thousands of Vikings fans up there in Minneapolis and throughout the world, but only a very small number of them probably want to live in a downtown setting. But there are many, many, many non-Vikings fans that might very well want to live in a downtown setting, and I think that's the much fatter part of the market.
Tom Fisher, as we ramp up this conversation, an email question here. Are the Vikings, you talk about the city, state, and county being on board, are the Vikings on board with this? That's key. I mean, this listener in this email notes that they wanted to be out in Arden Hills. They wanted to do that suburb thing. So are they on board with everything we've just been talking about?
I think so. The Vikings are very much excited about this. And, you know, one of their biggest competitors is high-definition television. They need to try to get people away from their family rooms watching the game and come to the stadium and watch it in person. And so the more they can create an exciting, dynamic experience, the more successful they will be.
Steph Curtis, any more comments there on our features page?
Mikey says, keep rollerblading at the stadium.
That is huge. And you can run in the winter, too. We should not underestimate that as well. Tom Fisher from the University of Minnesota, thank you so much.
Thank you.
For being with us this hour. Tim Chapin, thanks for your time from Florida State University as
well. My pleasure.
Comments always welcome on the Daily Circuit feature page at mprnews.org. This is the Daily Circuit. Next hour, we're going to talk with Rick Nelson from the Star Tribune about your favorite holiday restaurants. Where do you just have to go? What screams holiday tradition for you? I have to go to this restaurant because it's the holidays. We'll talk about that with Rick Nelson next hour on the Daily Circuit.